Well, it is a genuine pleasure for me to be here today, and especially to be speaking in an interdisciplinary forum like this, since for the last 25 years or so I've been devoting my life to trying to create such interdisciplinary fora. So I'm just delighted to be here. Those of you who have attended both literary and scientific conferences will have noticed the different rhetorics used in those conferences. In a scientific conference, one always sees, of course, view graphs and slides. And in a literature conference, by contrast, you hardly ever see any slides, you never see any view graphs, and you hear people read papers, which in scientific circles is considered barbarous beyond measure. So since I am crossing the disciplines today in my talk, I thought it would be appropriate to also cross rhetorics. So the first half of my talk will be a view to the scientists, and I'll be using view graphs. For the second half of my talk, I'll be reading some very condensed prose in true literary fashion. My talk today is drawn from my forthcoming book, which Jim mentioned in his generous introduction. And briefly, in that book, I tried to tell three interrelated stories. One story is how information lost its body, that is, how it became a reified concept considered to be independent of whatever substrata embodied it. The second story, it follows the cultural and technological construction of the cyborg from the immediate post-World War II period to the present. The third story talks about the transformation of the human into something that, for convenience, I'm calling the post-human. And it's that story that I'll be presenting in extremely condensed fashion for us here today. So if we're even going to think about a term like the post-human, we obviously have to have some notion of what it means to talk about the human. So for convenience, we can refer to a particular version of the human that gained popularity in the 19th century and continued strongly, certainly into the 20th, and I would say even into the present. Some of its principal assumptions are articulated by C.B. McPherson in his classic study, The Philosophy of Possessive Individualism. And basically what McPherson argues in this book is that the liberal subject, that is, that particular notion of the human, is founded, first of all, on the idea that the human is a human because he or she can own himself. And that it's this ability to own oneself that then forms the basis for all future market relations. It's because you own your body, you own yourself, for example, that you can sell your labor. And in his study, McPherson notices what he calls a paradox. And the paradox is this. In his tracing of liberal philosophy, the notion of the self comes out of this idea that you can own yourself. In that sense, it predates market relations. And yet McPherson is aware that it's precisely the rise of market economies that gives notion to this idea of the human, gives rise to this notion of the human. So he recognizes this as a sort of chicken and egg problem, a kind of paradox problem, but he doesn't really know what to do with it, and so he simply leaves it hanging. Nevertheless, founded on this notion that one can own oneself, McPherson then shows how the qualities that we would typically associate with the liberal subject come into being. Autonomy, rationality, free will, agency, and of course consciousness as the seat of identity. Well, now I'm going to switch to the immediate post-World War II period in the United States and talk about how the development of cybernetics began dismantling this notion of the liberal humanist subject. A fascinating figure in this regard is Norbert Wiener. Norbert Wiener, at least in my reading of his work, was really deeply committed to the notion of a liberal subject. He was also, of course, deeply committed to developing cybernetics as a kind of metadisciplinary paradigm. And I read his work as a taking place or unfolding in a sometimes uncomfortable and even acute tension between these two projects. Let me just, in the briefest terms, sketch out for you how cybernetics might begin to dismantle some of those assumptions. Cybernetics is really born when control theory, which had a fairly good idea of feedback loops from the 19th century on, was joined with the powerful and emerging concept of information. As soon as one gets the idea of a system being formed by information cycling through a feedback loop, then it becomes clear that the subject is no longer, in fact, autonomous. The subject becomes part of an informational system, and the feedback loop may make it difficult to determine exactly where the boundaries of the subject lie. I'll give you a quick example. Gregory Bateson used to ask his graduate students, is a blind man's cane part of him? Well, in the sort of traditional view, you would have no difficulty responding no. But in the cybernetic view, if the system is formed by the circulation of information, then you would have to say the blind man's cane, in fact, is part of him, considered as an informational system, because it's an essential way in which he gathers information about the environment. So in this way, cybernetics, even in its early phase, recognized that there was something in this idea of systems constituted through information flow that was potentially destabilizing to the idea of an autonomous subject. But in the early phase of cybernetics, in that immediate post-World War II period, kind of marked by the Macy conferences happening between 1946 and 1953, nobody really knew what to do very much with this idea. And it was recognized by some of the participants, Gregory Bateson, for example, Margaret Mead is another example, that implicit in this idea of the feedback loop was a very dangerous, powerful, and promising idea of reflexivity, and that the notion of reflexivity, that is, that which is used to generate the system is in fact itself part of the system, as when you consider the observer bound by a feedback loop to the system, reflexivity had tremendous power to unsettle conventional notions, but they didn't know quite what to do with it. Well, after the Macy conferences ended, what I call the second wave of cybernetics really took that as its founding challenge or its founding problem, what to do with this notion of reflexivity. And one of the interesting programs that developed out of that was articulated by Umberto Maturana and Francisco Varela in their idea of autopoiesis. Varela and Maturana are biologists, and Maturana was concerned to give an account of biological functioning and of cognition that did not import into it at the beginning what he saw as all these anthropomorphic assumptions that had characterized traditional biological thought. So he got the idea that, in fact, the system itself, considered as a living organism, is bound in a feedback loop where the components of the system produce the system, and the system functioning as a system produces the components as part of that system. So in essence, this was Maturana's idea of autopoiesis, a term, a made-up term, a neologism, meaning self-making. Now, in order to try to exploit the full power of this notion of autopoietic systems, Maturana made a heretical and, in my view, probably fallacious assumption. And that is, he assumed that systems are informationally closed to their environment, that things that happen in the environment are triggers for system-generated events, but perception itself never happens. It simply triggers something within this closed system that he conceived the organism to be. Now, this approach had a number of implications that, again, seemed to go against common sense. In his view, time, causality, and even information flow between the environment and the system become punctuations that an observer can put into the situation but do not themselves exist in the situation as such. Well, now if we think back to what's happening to this idea of the human in Maturana's scheme, as a result of this kind of thinking, Maturana came up with a greatly expanded notion of cognition. For him, cognition essentially was the autopoietic cycling within a system. So he was willing to say even an organism without a central nervous system was capable of cognition. And consciousness came about when the system began operating upon its own representations to create more representations. So what this has done then is two things that are extremely important. One is it gives a greatly expanded notion of cognition, and the second is it displaces consciousness from being sort of the seat of identity, the seat of essence of the organism, to being a sort of minor side effect generated when you get into second order cycling between representations. And that then marks the sort of distinctive flavor of what I call the second wave of cybernetics. In the third wave of cybernetics, one way to understand the emergence of this wave is to join the idea of dismantling of body boundaries, which so perplexed people in the first wave, with the reflexivity that really was the leitmotif of the second wave. So in this third wave, characterized by the development of virtual technologies and the idea of virtuality, we get a strong challenge to the common sense notion that we know where body boundaries begin and end. And we also get a strong interest in sort of the reflexive problems that come when human consciousness is engaging with a simulacra of itself. So to give you just a few touchstones for the way this problem has been discussed, many of you will know this work in detail, Sandy Stone's argument in her book, The War Between Desire and Technology at the Close of the Mechanical Age, arguing that virtual technologies are in fact destabilizing an assumption central to our legal and cultural institutions, one body, one person. And she's suggesting that what virtual technologies are doing is creating structures where we have to say that the subject is warranted by the body but not contained in the body, so that you can have multiple subjectivities attached to a single body. Another touchstone for us, Howard Rheingold's argument that intelligent machines are resulting in a symbiotic union between humans and intelligent machines that he sees as marking the next stage of human evolution in the process he calls intelligence augmentation. Marcus Novak's work as an architect, tracing the ways in which the development of virtual spaces are strongly interacting with notions of subjectivity. Jed Rasula's suggestion that not only is the computer a prosthesis, but in fact the body itself is a prosthesis, the body itself being the prosthesis into which we are born and which we have to learn to operate in much the same way that we later learn to operate technological prostheses. And then a whole body of work that I can only touch on here, beginning to think about external memory storage as a crucial stage in human evolution and the development of human culture, discussed in terms that clearly highlight the importance of the computer as a kind of evolutionary breakthrough. So these are how we get then to the idea of the post-human. And again, just to touch in the briefest way on some of the work where we can see the idea of the post-human being strongly articulated, Marvin Minsky's work in Society of Mind, arguing for distributed cognition among multiple autonomous agents, each of which runs its own simple program. Work like Tubey and Cosmides in The Adapted Mind, where they look at now evolution of consciousness in these terms, arguing essentially for a computer module model in the development of human consciousness. Consciousness is an emergent property in a book like Daniel Dennett's Consciousness Explained. The notion that somehow information coding goes through all levels of the subject from cognition into physical structure, articulated by Hans Moravec and Mind Children, and then more political work like Chris Gray's, where he's talking about the complete incorporation of the individual into market relations. Well, in this work, I'd like to mark for us what I see as a very significant split between people who are writing different versions of the post-human. And for me, that split takes place along the issue of embodiment. So for someone like Hans Moravec, who argues that it will soon be possible to download human consciousness into a computer, human identity basically is an informational pattern. And he argues that it doesn't matter what substrate this informational pattern is encoded in. It can be a biological body, but in a fantasy scenario where he imagines a robot surgeon puring a brain and transferring the information into a computer, the point of that scenario is that he thinks consciousness could exist in exactly the same form if only you could read all of that information and put it into a computer. So for him, embodiment is entirely irrelevant. And I'd like to say I strongly disagree with that. I think that's a gross simplification, but that's one extreme position. On the other end of the spectrum, there's someone like Gerald Adelman arguing that embodiment is crucial to modeling neural complexity and trying to do that in his neuronal group selection modeling with robots. Tony DiMaggio, in his book, Descartes' Error, arguing that embodiment, in fact, is an essential part of consciousness and that we could not have consciousness without embodiment because part of consciousness are emotions, are feelings, and these are, as he says, the body murmuring to the mind. And finally, Varela, Thompson, and Raj, who are arguing that embodiment is linked not just with consciousness but with awareness, and arguing against all the cognitive science models that don't take embodiment fully into account. Well, now let me just make a brief segue. I will not be talking in my talk today about literature at all, because that would be a whole other different talk. But I need just to pick up a couple of ideas that I've worked with in terms of literary texts, because I'm going to be speaking about them more in just a moment. It seems to me, as we think about these notions of the post-human that I've been speaking about, that it's useful to make a distinction between two different dialectics. And here I'm using, for those of you who know the semiotic square, a kind of linguistic technology that was developed by Gramos to systematically map out the different conceptual possibilities in any situation. And so I'm using here as the top axis of this square a dialectic between presence and absence, and want to contrast that with randomness and pattern, mostly because we're talking about a shift where the body is increasingly seen as information, and information cannot adequately be understood in these terms, in terms of presence and absence, because it's neither a presence nor an absence. Rather, as Moravec and a lot of other people insist, it's a pattern, and that pattern is always in dynamic tension with randomness. So if we think about the possibilities that through which these different terms could interact, and you think about presence interacting with pattern, we could call that axis replication. Absence interacting with randomness, we could call that disruption. And now just, well, I think I'll skip that next one. It's simply too detailed for this discussion. Well, with these sort of introductory comments then, let me get to the question I really want to entertain for us today. And that question seems to me to arise as soon as you begin thinking, okay, something really significant is happening in our shifts, some significant shift is happening in our ideas about what constitutes the human. And that question is, what are we to make of the post-human? What does all this add up to? What does it signify? How are we to react to it? What are we to make of it? And here I switch to my text. At least for me, the prospect of becoming post-human both terrifies and gives pleasure. Perhaps I can summarize the implications of the post-human by interrogating the sources of this terror and pleasure. The terror is relatively easy to understand. Post, with its dual connotation of superseding the human and coming after it, hints that the days of the human may be numbered. Some researchers, notably Hans Moravec, but also my UCLA colleague Michael Dyer and many others, believe this is true not only in a general intellectual sense of displacing one definition of the human with another, but in a more disturbingly literal sense that envisions humans displaced as the dominant life form on the planet by intelligent machines. Humans can either go gently into that good night, joining the dinosaurs as a species that once ruled the world but is now obsolete, or hang on for a while longer by becoming machines themselves. In either case, Moravec and like-minded thinkers believe the age of the human is drawing to a close. This view echoes the deeply pessimistic sentiments of Warren McCullough in his old age, who remarked, quote, "Man, to my mind, is about the nastiest, most destructive of all the animals. I don't see any reason, if we can evolve machines that can have more fun than he himself can, why they shouldn't take over, enslave us quite happily. They might have a lot more fun, invent better games than we ever did." Is it any wonder that faced with such dismal scenarios, most people have understandably negative reactions? If this is what the post-human means, why shouldn't it be resisted? Fortunately, these views do not exhaust the meanings of the post-human. As I have argued, human being is first of all embodied being, and the complexities of this embodiment mean that human awareness unfolds in very different ways than intelligence embodied in cybernetic machines. Although Moravec's dream of downloading human consciousness into a computer would likely come in for some hard knocks in literature departments, which tend to be skeptical of any kind of transcendence, but especially transcendence through technology, literary study shares with Moravec a major blind spot when it comes to the significance of embodiment. This blind spot is most evident, perhaps, when literary and cultural critics confront the field of evolutionary biology. From an evolutionary biologist's point of view, modern humans, for all their technological prowess, nevertheless represent an eye blink in the history of life, far too recent to have significant evolutionary impact on human biological behaviors and structures. In my view, arguments like those Jared Diamond advances in Guns, Germs, and Steel, and Why Sex is Fun, should be taken seriously. The body is the net result of thousands of years of sedimented evolutionary history, and it is naive to think that this history does not affect human behaviors at every level of thought and action. Of course, the reflexivity that looms large in cybernetics also inhabits evolutionary biology. The models proposed by evolutionary biologists have encoded within them cultural attitudes and assumptions formed by the same history they propose to analyze. As with cybernetics, observer and system are reflexively bound up with one another. To take only one example, the computer module model advanced by Tooby and Cosmides in The Adapted Mind to explain human evolutionary psychology testifies at least as much to the importance of information technologies in shaping contemporary worldviews as it does to human brain function. Nevertheless, these reflexive complexities do not negate the importance of the sedimented history incarnated within the body. interpreted through metaphors resonant with cultural meanings, the body itself is a congealed metaphor, a physical structure whose constraints and possibilities have been formed by an evolutionary history intelligent machines do not share. Humans may enter into symbiotic relationships with intelligent machines, already the case on many places on the globe. They may be displaced by intelligent machines, already in effect, for example, at Japanese and American factories using robotic arms for assembly labor. But there is a limit to how seamlessly they can be articulated with machines because they remain distinctively different from intelligent machines in their embodiments. The terror, while it does not disappear in this view, tends away from the apocalyptic and toward a more moderate view of seriated social, cultural, and technological changes. What about the pleasures? For some people, including me, the post-human evokes the exhilarating prospect of getting out of some of the old boxes and opening up new ways of thinking about what the human means. In positing a shift from presence-absence to pattern randomness, I have sought to show how these categories can be transformed from the inside to arrive at new kinds of cultural configurations, which may soon render such dualities obsolete. This process of transformation is fueled by tensions between the assumptions encoded in pattern randomness as opposed to presence-absence. In Derrida's performance of presence-absence, presence is allied with logos, God, teleology, in general, with an originary plenitude that can act to ground signification and give the trajectory of history order and meaning. The work of Eric Havelock, among others, demonstrates how in Plato's Republic, this view of originary presence authorized a stable, coherent self that could witness and testify to a stable, coherent reality. Through these and other means, the metaphysics of presence front-loaded meaning into the system. Meaning was guaranteed because a stable origin existed. It is now a familiar story how deconstruction exposed the inability of systems to posit their own origins, thus ungrounding signification and rendering meaning indeterminate. As the presence-absence hierarchy was destabilized and absence was privileged over presence, lack displaced plenitude, desire usurped certitude. Important as these moves have been in 20th century thought, however, they still took place within a presence-absence dialectic. One feels lack only if presence is posited or assumed. One is driven by desire only if the object of desire is conceptualized as something to be possessed. Just as the metaphysics of presence required an originary plenitude to articulate a stable self, deconstruction required a metaphysics of presence to articulate the destabilization of that self. By contrast, pattern randomness is underlaid by a very different set of assumptions. In this dialectic, meaning is not front-loaded into the system, and the origin does not act to ground signification. In multi-agent simulations, for example, complexity evolves from highly recursive processes being applied to simple rules. Rather than proceeding along a trajectory toward a known end, such systems evolve toward an open future marked by contingency and unpredictability. Meaning is not guaranteed here by a stable origin. Rather, it is made possible, but not inevitable, by the blind force of evolution finding workable solutions within given parameters. Although pattern has traditionally been the privileged term, for example, among the electrical engineers developing information theory, randomness has increasingly been seen to play a fruitful role in the evolution of complex systems. For Chris Langdon and Stuart Kaufman, chaos accelerates the evolution of biological and artificial life. For Francesco Varela, randomness is the froth of noise from which coherent microstates evolve and to which living systems owe their capacity for fast, flexible response. For Henri Atlan, noise is the murmuring of the body from which emerges complex communication between different levels in a biological system. Although these models differ in their specifics, they agree in seeing randomness not simply as the lack of pattern, but as the creative ground from which pattern can emerge. Indeed, it is not too much to say that in these and similar models, randomness rather than pattern is invested with plenitude. If pattern is the realization of a certain set of possibilities, randomness is the much, much larger set of everything else, from phenomenon that cannot be rendered coherent by a system's organization to those it cannot perceive at all. In Bateson's cybernetic epistemology, randomness is what exists outside the confines of the box in which a system is located. It is the larger and unknowable complexity for which the perceptual processes of the organism are a metaphor. Significance is achieved by evolutionary processes that ensure those systems which survive are the ones whose organizations instantiate metaphors adequate to this complexity, unthinkable in itself. When Varela and his co-authors in Embody Mind argue there is no stable, coherent self, only autonomous agents running programs, they envision pattern as a limitation that drops away as human awareness expands beyond consciousness and encounters the emptiness that, in another guise, could equally be called the chaos from which all forms emerge. What do these developments mean for the post-human? When the self is envisioned as grounded in presence, identified with originary guarantees and teleological trajectories, associated with solid foundations and logical coherence, the post-human is likely to be seen as anti-human because it envisions the conscious mind as a small subsystem running its program of self-construction and self-assurance while remaining ignorant of the actual dynamics of complex systems. And Rodney Brooks likes to illustrate this by saying, as an example of how ignorant consciousness is of the actual operation of the system, most people go through their entire lives without realizing that there's a large black spot right in the middle of their visual field. But the post-human does not really mean the end of humanity. Instead, it signals the end of a certain conception of the human that may have applied at best to that fraction of humanity who had the wealth, power, and leisure to conceptualize themselves as autonomous beings exercising their will through individual agency and choice. What is lethal is not the post-human as such, but the grafting of the post-human onto a liberal humanist view of the self. When Moravec imagines you choosing to download yourself into a computer, thereby obtaining through technological mastery the ultimate privilege of immortality, he is not abandoning the autonomous liberal subject, but expanding its prerogatives into the realm of the post-human. Yet the post-human need not be recuperated back into liberal humanism, nor need it be construed as anti-human. Located within the dialectic of pattern randomness and grounded in embodied actuality rather than disembodied information, the post-human offers resources for rethinking the articulation of humans with intelligent machines. To explore these resources, let us return to Gregory Bateson's ideas that those organisms which survive will be the ones whose internal structures are good metaphors for the complexity without. What kind of environments will be created by the expanding power and sophistication of intelligent machines? As Richard Lanham has pointed out, in the information-rich environments created by ubiquitous computing, the limiting factor is not the speed of computers, nor the rates of transmission through fiber optic cables, nor the amount of data that can be generated and stored. Rather, the scarce commodity is human attention. And it seems to me that it's no accident that in the 1980s a disorder is recognized and diagnosed attention deficit disorder. It makes sense then that technological innovation will focus on compensating for this bottleneck. An obvious solution is to design intelligent machines to attend to choices and tasks that do not have to be done by humans. For example, there are already in existence intelligent agent programs to sort email, discarding unwanted messages and prioritizing the rest. The programs work along lines similar to neural nets. They tabulate the choices the human operator makes and feed this information back in recursive loops to readjust the weights given to various kinds of email addresses. After an initial learning period, the sorting program takes over more and more of your email management, freeing you to give your attention to other matters. And those of us who spend 2 hours a day answering our email know what it would be like to be able to have a program that would do that. If we extrapolate from these relatively simple programs to an environment which, as Charles Osman likes to put it, supplies synthetic sentience on demand, human consciousness would ride on top of a highly articulated and complex computational ecology in which many decisions invisible to human attention would be made by intelligent machines. Joseph Weizenbaum, foreseeing just such an ecology over 2 decades ago, argued passionately that judgment is a uniquely human function and must not be turned over to computers. With the rapid development of neural nets and expert programs, it is no longer so clear that sophisticated judgment cannot be made by machines, and in some instances, made more accurately than by humans. But the issue, in Weizenbaum's view, involves more than whether or not the programs work. Rather, he regards it as an ethical imperative that humans keep control. To do otherwise is to abdicate their responsibilities as autonomous, independent beings. What Weizenbaum's argument makes clear is the connection between the assumption undergirding the liberal humanist subject and the ethical position that humans, not machines, must be in control. Such an argument assumes a vision of the human in which conscious agency is the essence of human identity. Sacrifice this, and the human is hopelessly compromised, contaminated with machinic alienness in the very heart of our humanity. Hence the urgency, even the panic, in Weizenbaum's insistence that in judgment is uniquely human function. At stake for him is nothing less than what it means to be human. In the post-human view, by contrast, conscious agency has never been in control. In fact, the very illusion of control bespeaks a fundamental ignorance about the nature of emergent processes through which consciousness, the organism, and the environment are constituted. Mastery through the exercise of autonomous will is merely the story consciousness tells itself to explain results that otherwise come about through chaotic and emergent structures. If, as a numerous feminist of critics have argued, there is a relation between the desire for mastery and objectivist account of science and the imperialist project of subduing nature, then the post-human offers resources for construction of another kind. In this account, emergence replaces teleology, reflexive epistemology replaces objectivism, distributed cognition replaces autonomous will, embodiment replaces a body seen as a support system for the mind, and a dynamic partnership between humans and intelligent machines replaces the manifest destiny of the liberal humanist subject to dominate and control nature. Of course, this is not necessarily what the post-human will mean, only what it can mean if certain strands among the complex seriations are highlighted and combined to create a vision of the human that uses the post-human as leverage to avoid reinscribing and thus repeating some of the mistakes of the past. Just as the human need not be anti-human, so it need not be apocalyptic. Edwin Hutchins addresses the idea of distributed cognition in his nuanced study of the navigational systems of ocean-going ships. His meticulous research shows that the cognitive system responsible for locating the ship in space and navigating it successfully resides not in humans alone, but in the complex interactions within an environment that includes both human and non-human actors. His study allows him to give an excellent response to John Searle's famous Chinese Room. Searle challenged the idea that machines can think by imagining a situation in which communication in Chinese takes place without the actors ever knowing what their actions meant. Suppose, Searle said, he was stuck inside a room, he who knows not a word of Chinese. Texts in Chinese are slid through a slot in the door. He has in the room with him baskets of Chinese characters and a rule book correlating the symbols written on the text with other symbols in the baskets. Using the rule book, he assembles strings of characters and pushes them out the door. Although his Chinese interlocutors take these strings to be clever responses to their inquiries, Cyril has not the least idea of what the texts he has produced mean. Therefore, it would be a mistake to say that machines can think, he argues, for like him, they produce comprehensible results without comprehending anything themselves. In Hutchins' neat interpretation, Cyril's argument is valuable precisely because it makes clear that it is not Cyril, but the entire room that knows Chinese. In this distributed cognitive system, the Chinese room knows more than any of its components, including Cyril. The situation of modern humans is akin to Cyril in the Chinese room, for every day we participate in systems whose total cognitive capacity exceeds our individual knowledge, including such devices as cars with electronic ignition systems, microwaves with computer chips that precisely adjust power levels, fax machines that warble to other fax machines, and electronic watches that communicate with a timing radio wave to set themselves and correct their date. Modern humans are capable of more sophisticated cognition than cavemen, not because moderns are smarter, Hutchins concludes, but because they have constructed smarter environments in which to work. Hutchins would no doubt disagree with Weizenbaum's view that judgment should be reserved for humans alone. Like cognition, decision-making is distributed between human and non-human agents, from the steam-powered steering system that suddenly failed on a Navy vessel Hutchins was studying, to the charts and pocket calculators the navigators were then forced to use. He shows convincingly that these adaptations to changed circumstances were evolutionary and embodied rather than abstract and consciously designed. The solution to the problem caused by this sudden failure of the steering mechanism was, quote, clearly discovered by the organization of the system as a whole before it was discovered by any of its participants. Seen in this perspective, the prospect of humans working in partnership with intelligent machines is not so much a usurpation of human right and responsibility as it is a further development in the construction of distributed cognitive environments that have been ongoing for thousands of years. Also changed in this perspective is the relation of human subjectivity to its environment. No longer is human will conceived as the source from which emanates the mastery necessary to dominate and control the environment. Rather, the distributed cognition of the emergent human subject correlates with, in Bateson's phrase, becomes a metaphor for, the distributed cognitive system as a whole in which thinking is done by human and non-human actors. Quote, thinking consists of bringing these structures into coordination so they can shape and be shaped by one another, Hutchins writes. To conceptualize the human in these terms is not to imperil human survival, but precisely to enhance it, for the more we understand the flexible, adaptive structures that coordinate our environments and the metaphors we ourselves are, the better we can fashion images of ourselves that accurately reflect the complex interplays that ultimately make of the world one system. This view of the post-human also offers resources for thinking in more sophisticated ways about virtual technologies. As long as the human subject is envisioned as an autonomous self with unambiguous boundaries, the human-computer interface can only be parsed as a division between the solidity of real life on one side and the illusion of virtual reality on the other, just thus obscuring the far-reaching changes initiated by the development of virtual technologies. Only if one thinks of the subject as an autonomous self independent of the environment is one likely to experience the panic seen in certain chapters of Wiener's Cybernetics. This view of the self authorizes the fear that if the boundaries are breached at all, there will be nothing to stop the self's complete dissolution. By contrast, when the human is seen as part of a distributed system, the full expression of human capability can be seen precisely to depend on the cybernetic splice rather than be imperiled by it. Writing in another context, Hutchins arrives at an insight profoundly applicable to virtual technologies. Quote, "What used to look like internalization of thought and subjectivity now appears as a gradual propagation of organized functional properties across a set of malleable media," unquote. This vision is a potent antidote to a view of virtuality that parses it as a division between an inert body left behind while a disembodied subjectivity inhabits a virtual realm, the construction of virtuality performed by Case in Gibson's Neuromancer when he delights in the bodiless exaltation of cyberspace. By contrast, in the model Hutchins presents, and that the post-human helps to authorize, human functionality expands because the parameters of the cognitive system it inhabits expands. In this model, it is not a question of leaving the body behind, but rather of extending embodied awareness in highly specific, local, and material ways that would be impossible without electronic prosthesis. Cybernetics was born in a froth of noise when Norbert Wiener first conceived of it as a way to maximize human potential in a world that was, in essence, chaotic and unpredictable. Like many pioneers, Wiener helped to initiate a journey that would prove to have consequences more far-reaching and subversive than even his formidable powers of imagination could conceive. As Bateson, Varela, and others would later argue, the noise crashes within as well as without. The chaotic, unpredictable nature of complex dynamics implies that subjectivity is emergent rather than given, distributed rather than located solely in consciousness, emergent from and integrated to chaotic world rather than occupying a position of mastery and control removed from it. Bruno Latour has argued that we have never been modern. The seriated history of cybernetics, emerging from networks at once materially real, socially regulated, and discursively constructed, suggests for similar reasons that we have always been post-human. In the three stories told in How We Become Post-Human, how information lost its body, how the cyborg was constructed, and how the human became the post-human, if these stories have at times seemed to present the post-human as a transformation to be feared and abhorred rather than welcomed and embraced, that reaction has everything to do with how the post-human is constructed and understood. The present moment is the best possible time to contest for what the post-human means before the trains of thought it embodies have been laid down so firmly it would take dynamite to change them. Although some versions of the post-human circulating within the culture point toward the anti-human and apocalyptic, it is possible to craft others that will be conducive to the long-range survival of humans and the other life forms, biological and artificial, with whom we share the planet. Thank you.
Catherine, why don't you remain up? We have several minutes. We can have questions.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, this idea that in an information-rich environment, pattern and randomness are privileged over presence and absence can be found in a lot of theorists who are interested in information. And let me just instance again, I don't want to use him as a whipping boy, but Hans Moravec, where he argues essentially that human beings are patterns. And in fact, Wiener had much the same idea when he suggested it would be possible to telegraph a human being. He argued, you know, our cells replace each other. We can't be ourselves. What are we? We're a pattern. And if you have that pattern, then you have all that matters. And obviously, that's a view that, in my opinion, does not begin to take account of the complexities of embodiment, but it's a view that's in, made possible, enabled by a view of information as a kind of bodiless fluid that can circulate effortlessly among different substrate. As to the interplay between pattern and randomness, that actually, as some of you here may know, forms a really interesting debate within the development of information theory, where information theorists are arguing, is information better understood as pattern, or in fact is information better understood as randomness? And so a kind of conciliator like Warren Weaver wants to argue both of those terms are necessary to produce information, and it's sort of the productive tension between them that makes information possible. So by putting them in a dialectic, I didn't necessarily mean that they were antagonistic, but they were in fact bound together in this fruitful tension that someone like Weaver sees as producing information.
I'm wondering whether there's some disconnect here, and whether that word is being used instead of complexity, maybe you should say
what I mean by randomness is any set of anything, data, for example, in which no discernible pattern can be found. A string of random numbers would be a good example of the way in which I'm using randomness. Well, it depends on how you define information. If you define information as the ability of a message to surprise the receiver, which is one of the ways that it was defined in the early days of information theory, then maximum information comes with maximum surprise. So that, for example, if I start a nursery rhyme and I tell you, I'm going to tell you a nursery rhyme, and I said, Mary had a little lamb, even though there's three more lines to that message, no more information is conveyed because it's highly redundant in our cultural context. If there's no redundancy in the message, if I'm, for example, giving you a string of random numbers in which you're constantly surprised because you have no idea of what the next number is going to be, in one formulation of information, that conveys the maximum amount of information. And so in that sense, see, the issue is, does information imply structure or no? Is information simply giving you something you didn't already know?
You're talking about information as if it
doesn't come. Well, that's how you
hear it. Well, of course, for an electrical engineer, it has no context. I mean, that is one of the important moves that's made in the development of information theory, to decontextualize information and to define it in such a way that its quantitative value will be independent of its context. Yeah?
I'm wondering whether you've thought about, what you're describing in some sense is an evolutionary development of humankind. We are the missing link, and you're describing Homo post-sapiens. It seems to me that actually in the next century there's going to be another revolution, this time dominated by embodiment. In other words, when we figure out how to change our genes, then we will start designing new bodies, minds, new creatures. And that sort of, in some sense, in old fashioned,
way of evolving, not have information, but they're redesigning many different kinds of things.
Yes.
Have you thought about that?
Yes.
Revolution, the underlying
I don't know, did you folks on this side of the room hear that at all?
The
comment was that although my focus here has been on intelligent machines, there's another evolutionary revolution, if you will, on the horizon, and that is the technological designing of our own bodies through genetic manipulation and such. And what does that revolution, which is very much concerned with the body, have to do with the sort of thing that I was talking about? And of course, one way that gets worked out is through the cyborg. That is, through the union of intelligent machines and biological components into a single organism. And I don't need to tell you all the variations that have been played on that, both in actual scientific work and in popular culture. But I think that these two different approaches, in fact, have this huge meeting ground where you get a technologically augmented human being that includes implants, as the people at Xerox PARC like to call them, as well as explants of various kinds. Yes.
As many people in this room know, we're starting a cognitive science program here at the CSUJ. It seems to me that the ideas about embodiment, and I want to make sure to include ecology and evolution in that, really have a negative implication for perhaps the major insight of cognitive science, which is that you can study cognitive systems in organisms or in machines, and that it's a common enterprise. Ironically, it kind of echoes what the behavior of psychologists thought they could do by studying the old animal and rats or small and sheep, but with them, it doesn't matter. And do you think, in fact, that this has a serious negative implication for a unified discipline of cognitive science?
Well, of course, it would be very presumptuous for me as a humanist to be telling you cognitive science what you're about, so I will defer answering your direct question and sort of give you my opinion on certain of those developments. It seems to me that there is a very sharp split, at least among the cognitive science that I have read about, between those who think embodied processes are central to cognition and those who think a computer simulation of those cognitive processes amounts to the same thing. And I guess part of the debate here would hinge on whether or not you're actually trying to model human thought, or whether you're trying by whatever means to come up with the equivalent answer or solution to what human thought would come up with. And it seems to me that actually modeling human thought is the immensely more difficult project than to create an artificial intelligence that can come up with comparable results. And of course, this has a long and rich history in cognitive science that you cognitive scientists will know much better than I do. But I don't have any quarrel with people who say, let's make intelligent machines that can do neat things. I think that's great. Let's do make intelligent machines that can do neat things. My only worry comes when the difference between those two projects begins to be erased or forgotten. And the claim is that, like Moravec's claim, to have a program running in a computer is exactly the same thing as to have human consciousness. And that, I think, is ultimately not defensible. I think ultimately you cannot sustain that claim. And that when you try to do the kind of actual modeling of neuronal structures that people like Gerald Adelman are doing, you have only to go to visit his lab and see the little robots collecting colored blocks to realize the immense gap that's separating this artificial intelligence modeled on actual human neuronal structures to what human neuronal structures can actually do. And I think Adelman is someone who's, you know, very conscious of that. I mean, he doesn't for a moment think that he's actually creating human complexity. And his work points to that gap, I think. I've probably stepped on all kinds of toes by even venturing an opinion on this, but that is my opinion. Tori?
I'm just curious to shift this a little bit. Since your background is in Caltech and chemistry, and then you made the move and teach humanities and literature and explains the audience you have here, what prompted you to make that shift? And then how does that inform the work you're doing now and how you see the sciences?
Well, I was really prompted to make the shift because I yearn to ask the big questions, like sort of philosophers are driven to do. And of course, the bigger the question you ask, the more unanswerable it becomes. So I wanted to ask the big questions. And how that relates to the work that I'm doing now is that it's clear to the people who are working in these fields, like Rodney Brooks with his robots and Edelman with his other robots and Moravec and so forth, it's clear to them that they are working with ideas that have really revolutionary implications about how we think about the human. But it's really not their business to think through those implications. Their business is to build the machines and to make the technical arguments. Well, who is going to think about those implications? People like me, I would venture to say, you know. And that's really what fascinates me about this kind of work, that I'm very interested in what all this implies about how we construct and how we think about the human, and trying systematically to relate that to these different research programs.
And do you see Brooks, for instance, as an example, actually becoming involved in a project where he works with a philosopher the debate goes on while the project is being built, and it becomes a real collaboration rather than he does something, you comment on it, he reads it maybe not.
Yeah, it would be wonderful to have collaborative projects like that. But I think at the same time there is a real difficulty in vocabulary, and on both sides of the fence, for the humanist struggling to understand the scientist's vocabulary, but also the scientist struggling to understand the humanist vocabulary. So simply to get to the point where you both know what the terms you're using in common means, in my experience, takes quite a while. And so it clearly is a kind of project that requires commitment from both sides of the fence.
Maybe one or two more questions. We have these are happening, but we have a reception that we must finish by 4 for the next part. So go ahead and perhaps
one. One comment on the terminology. It would be possible to think about what the brain does in terms of cognition, somewhat distinct from the question of identity and consciousness. In other words, consciousness could be used for cognition. It could be used for identity. It could also be used for sentience. And these three seem to be quite distinct. Then there's ethics. Do you have any comments on what does cognitive science do with that? Or the function of
Wow, those are two huge questions. One of the things that is implicit in the sort of shift that I was tracing is a decentering of consciousness as the seat of identity. So that consciousness becomes kind of an add-on, a little program run to adjudicate disputes, but by no means the main show. So it probably is important, at least it's important for people like Verhaelen, Thompson, and Roche to distinguish between sentience or, let us say, intelligence, consciousness and awareness. For them, those are all terms that have distinctly different meanings. As to your question about ethics, well, it seems to me that ethics is bound up with this shift deeply and profoundly, because what do you think? You have to have an idea of the essence of the human in order to be able to formulate a coherent idea about ethics. And when that idea of what the human is changes, then all your ethical assumptions, and I won't say all, many of your ethical assumptions change as well. Yeah?
Basically a mechanistic model, right? Because you imagine things moving.
Yes.
Information being processed.
Yes.
Ethics usually seems to be based in some notion of sentience, in other words, we attribute ethical value to other organisms to the degree that we feel that sentience and feel pleasure.
Yes.
Now, even the this is going very quickly to cover, even the evolutionary world would see pleasure and pain as somehow ethics and all this. And thus, not surprising to your basis. I mean, I think that's a good point.
Well, I agree. These are very complex matters. But to give fair space to the other side, someone like Michael Dyer would want to argue like this. Through recursive programming, I can create a machine that has very complex affectional states. And moreover, I can create a machine that can tell stories about to itself to try to increase its pleasure and diminish its pain, understood as these affectional states that are being built in to the machine. Now, here's where Searle's, you know, Chinese room argument would come into effect. If you wanted to say, the machine doesn't really feel those affectional states, the machine merely simulates those affectional states through its programs. And that's where the issue of embodiment perhaps becomes very important. But they would then say, you are a machine that simulates those affectional states through certain programs that your hardware runs.
Well, briefly,
we can continue. Yeah, so the point is then that if we adopt that model, and I think evolutionary psychology also makes a very convincing case for that model, that ethics becomes economic, the good becomes economic. It's not a really good thing.
Well, if you want to insist that ethics must be based on pleasure and pain.
Well, not necessarily on pleasure, but more on pleasure. But maybe we should speak
to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Lane. Thanks again to the ITP for hosting this. I believe we have a script.